So then continuing with text 241, it is prescribed that in times of distress, a student may learn the Veda from one who is not a Brahmana, and that he shall walk behind and serve such a teacher as long as the instruction lasts. So here where this point is being made, just before this, that here, one he who possesses faith may receive pure learning even from a man of lower caste, the highest law even from the lowest, and an excellent wife even from a base family. Even from poison nectar may be taken, even from a child good advice, even from a foe a lesson in good conduct, and even from an impure substance, gold. Excellent wives, learning, the knowledge of the law, rules of purity, good advice, and various arts may be acquired from anybody. So if there's a situation, means in times of distress, means when there is a difficulty in finding something, you know, what you are actually looking for. Means what is the standard of what you want to get. There's a difficulty in getting that. Then he may learn from whoever he can get the knowledge of the Veda from. Because the knowledge will be have been taught to the Brahmins, the Kshatriyas, the Vaishyas. But generally, the Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, they don't teach. Because of their being absorbed, you know, very much in their various activities. So it becomes hard for them to teach. You're going to put two in each? Huh? One. Okay. So then, you know, Kshatriya is busy with his management. So it's very hard for him to run regular classes in the Veda. Plus, because he's absorbed in management all the time, he'll generally tend to put a slant of management on his understanding of the Veda. So the tendency will be he will get away from the proper understanding. It means full understanding, complete understanding. Vaishya will have a tendency to look at it from profit and loss, because that's what he's having to do all day. But the Brahmin, he's supposed to be studying and then teaching based on that pure study. Therefore, there shouldn't be so much difficulty in this way. So it's recommended that one then study from someone who it's their occupational duty to teach. It means that is their preachers, their teachers. That is their main purpose. But it says here that if such a person who has that time to give and spend is not available, you can get from whoever it is that can give you that knowledge. Whoever has that knowledge, you take from them. Point is you must get the knowledge. Vedas are very practical. So if you need that knowledge, whoever can give it to you, you take from them. That's the point. So here, and it says, and you will walk behind and serve such a teacher as long as the instruction lasts. So when the instruction is finished, you don't necessarily have a relationship with them like they one would with the teacher that was talked about before. The one who could teach you in the whole philosophy of the Veda, the application of the Veda, and, you know, very much train one in that way. So that person, then, the whole life you have obligation towards. But someone who can just teach you in a portion or a particular art or something like that, in that field, in that time, then that respect, just like any teacher, would be given. But when it's over, then the relationship, the gratefulness is there. That always remains. But other than that, then one doesn't have the same obligation. You know, like, let's say you learn music from somebody, that you don't have that lifelong mood of surrender to that person. We have gratefulness every time we see them and we know they're our teacher, but you don't have the same surrender that will be there. But someone who can teach you in an actual Krishna conscious philosophy, the actual understanding of the Veda, that then we have a longer, that relationship is maintained. He who desires incomparable bliss in heaven shall not dwell during his whole life in the house of a non-Brahminical teacher, nor with a Brahmin who does not know the whole Veda and the Angas. Yeah. So, says here, is in brackets, in heaven, which doesn't necessarily mean. Here, he does, incomparable bliss means, we understand that incomparable, the heavenly planets are comparable. This one's better than that one. But when you get to the spiritual platform, that's incomparable. So here, this verse then by the non-devotees, then it will be seen that the person who doesn't know the whole Veda can't teach me everything about how I'm going to elevate myself to the heavenly planet. He can teach me a part. So he's very careful that he wants to get to heaven planets. He only learns from a teacher who can give him everything. So in the same, but for the devotee means that person who can give the whole understanding, then one is with him the whole time. Who can only give a portion of that understanding, then he doesn't dwell in his house the whole time. One will also study under others. In other words, what one can gain there, that is gained. But when once it is gained, you cannot gain any more. He will then continue his study under another teacher. Like that. This is the principle of the Siksha Guru, is that the spiritual master, if he is able to, as long as you advance, he is able to give you knowledge. Then one will take that instruction from that person. But if there comes a time when he has taught what he can to you, and you have surpassed that, or you need a different kind of instruction, then generally he will recommend that now you continue study under this person. Or it will be natural. These relationships are on, and that will naturally develop. That is not an uncommon thing. Just like we see with what's his name? I think the spiritual master is Sridhar Chaitanya, unless that was the devotee. He sent him to study under Rupa Goswami. Is his name Gauridas? So he went to study under Rupa Goswami. And then while he was in Vrindavan, he was given the service to sweep Nidiban every day. Shamananda. Yeah, no, he became called Shamananda, but before his name was something else. May have been Hridai Chaitanya or Hridai Chaitanya. Duki Krishna Das. Yeah, his guru was Hridai Chaitanya. So Hridai Chaitanya's guru sent him to study into Rupa because he was so vastly learned in the whole process of devotional service and all this. So he sent him there to learn, though he is the spiritual master. So when it went beyond what was considered proper etiquette, means word got back to him that after Radharani had changed his name and his tilak and his also his direction of study, his practice and devotional practice had changed, then Duki Krishna, Hridai Chaitanya, then he thought, well, this is a breach of etiquette. So he himself came to Vrindavan, So, it took some time for the news to get there, time for him to walk to Vrindavan. So, news traveled by word of mouth, but the mouth was also had to be connected to feet. So only when the feet walked from Vrindavan to Bengal, and then he heard about it, and then he took his feet and then walked to Vrindavan. So you're talking some months here. So then when he came, he was very upset. Then Radharani explained, no, I'm the one who changed the name and I have given these things. So therefore he accepted. Because even though the one who gives diksha, then the siksha is there, but it still cannot break the etiquette. It means the diksha guru is given the name, he's given, the basic teachings. So the siksha guru cannot adjust that. Otherwise that's not proper. He can refine it, develop it, take it to higher levels. That's what's expected. But not that you completely change the direction or change like that. So here the point is that one will go as far as he can. So one should be careful to look for a teacher who can take one as far as one can go. But if not, one will find anyone who actually has actual some knowledge, even if it's a portion, and take that knowledge. It means we're not fooled. We take what we can, where we can. That is the Vedic principle here. It says, but if a student desires to pass his whole life in the teacher's house, he may diligently serve him until he is freed from this body. A brahmana who serves his teacher till the dissolution of his body reaches forthwith the eternal mansion of Brahman. So this is the Naistika Brahmachari. The Naistika Brahmachari then remains with the teacher. He does not graduate. Means he takes the vow of Brahmacharya and he maintains that his whole life. So that is the Naistika. So it says here that by doing that, by remaining as a menial servant and all that, then at the dissolution of his body, then he says the eternal mansion of Brahman. So the impersonalist then can very happily take this to mean the Brahma Jyoti, but when it mentions the mansion, it means Brahman lives in a mansion. It's called the Nanda Bhavan, right? And it's Nanda Maharaj's house. So that is Brahman's mansion. So one reaches there because by performance of menial service within knowledge and devotion, that combination creates realization. This is the advantage of the brahmachari life, is that the menial activities, menial service done in knowledge and devotion gives realization. That's a very important aspect. This opportunity is very important. That's why Prabhupada mentions that the higher echelons of society always go to the Gurukul. Because by going to the Gurukul, one gets that opportunity. Because that menial service mixed with knowledge and devotion gives the realization that actually takes us back to Godhead. That is the important element. Therefore, everyone should start their life like that. And it's mentioned that the wife, doing her household duties, then gets the same benefit as such a brahmachari. That she gets the same benefits. Whatever the brahmachari gets by serving the spiritual master living in the ashram, the wife gets by doing the household duties. So that is a very, very essential element in the Vedic culture, is this aspect of the menial service, like this. So then, here that is afforded to everyone. The Vedas are very particular about, you know, the aspect of what nowadays we would call equal spiritual rights, right? But it understands the difference of nature of the different personalities, of the different ashrams, the different varnas, the different ages, different situations of life, is that one situation for one person doesn't afford the same facility. But it does in here. Here it may be very difficult. The brahmachari living in the ashram of the spiritual master, he has the nature, the naistika nature, then he can fix very nicely on that. But as we'll see as it goes on, there's very few who remain naistika brahmachari. So how many are getting this opportunity where they can fix their mind for such a long time? Like this. So this opportunity is then given. We see the girls, then it becomes very difficult. By the time that they hit 12 years old, they start thinking. They're not children. A boy at 12 is a child. A woman at 12 is a woman. She's already thinking of practical aspects of life. The boy doesn't think practically till he's 18, 19, 20. That's why in the Vedas it mentions that the difference in age between the boy and the girl should be a minimum between 6 and 10 years. Because a girl at 12 and a boy at 18 are actually on the same material platform. Because she's gotten serious at that age and the boy has not. So it becomes difficult for them to focus. But when one's put into that home environment, then it's very easy to focus on these things. There are things like to be done. The affection for the family members is there. So by performing those duties there, then that fixed attention, because we're working for devotees and all that, then one gets that same benefit. So Krishna is very nicely arranged that whatever the situation, that everybody can get the same benefit. Then, 2:45, he who knows the sacred law must not present any gift to his teacher before the Samvartana, but when with the permission of his teacher he is about to take the final bath, let him procure the present for the venerable man according to his ability. So means that he presented there the Naistika Brahmacharya. It means he doesn't leave. But the one who does leave, then he should not give a gift before he's graduated. Here it says the final bath. So the final bath is Samvartana. That is the samskar. That after joining the Gurukul, then there's a samskar called Samvartana, in which they become snatak, which means bathed, the one who is bathed. So there's a special ritual in which sacred water, then they sprinkle themselves with this water. And then the teacher washes the feet of the student. Very interesting. Is that at the beginning, the teacher circumambulates the student when one is accepting them as a brahmachari. And at the end, when they graduate, the teacher washes the feet of the student. Because the point is the student is a, you know, an advanced personality. It's a human being who has come for spiritual knowledge. So they're coming for knowledge, so this is very respectable. So even the teacher respects that at the beginning. And then the relationship is established. Because there you're only establishing the relationship. It hasn't been established. So he's respecting the student. And then when he's finished, he's respecting. And then he goes. But in between, then the student is respecting the teacher. And after that, also, the student respects that teacher. So he doesn't give a gift before such a point. Before the Samvartana, he does not give. Because then otherwise it looks like I'm paying you, therefore I deserve knowledge. But the teacher is teaching for free. Because this is the greatest knowledge, and there's nothing, it means you can't pay for it. It means afterwards, out of gratitude, then whatever one can afford, whatever is available to, then one gives that. But otherwise, you can't buy the teacher. That's why the Vedic thing, it wasn't a thing you paid and then you were taught. Because then the child may think, means, you know, I have paid, my parents have paid, family's paying, so the teacher has to do what I want. But the Vedic thing is no, you're coming. And then the child himself goes out begging every day. And by that begging, they whatever rice and vegetables they bring home, that's they pull that all together, that's what they cook. That's what they eat. And that's whatever he begs is given to the teacher. And then the teacher with that maintains the student. So it's just, he's there and it's part of his household duties. Like in the house, everybody's doing some duties. You know, someone's cleaning, someone's doing this, that, going to the market, so many things. So he goes out begging. And the teacher teaches. So therefore he's doing it for free. And then, at the end, then one who graduates means they're going to become a grihastha. So then they have to give something. Because they've gone on for material life, therefore they give material rewards. But one who doesn't graduate, he just stays in the ashram and all he does is render menial service. So the teacher serves by teaching and the student serves by listening, following and doing menial service. And then it works very nice. Therefore, pariprashna sevaya. That student who is interested in knowledge, pranipata, he then inquires submissively and serves. Then the exchange of knowledge becomes perfect. But he shouldn't present a present beforehand, otherwise it makes it feel like he's trying to get something. You know? And this also keeps materialistic people from doing such things. And materialistic teachers from accepting such things. So in this way it protects both sides. So what can be given, here it mentions, a field, gold, a cow, a horse, a parasol, and shoes. Oh, a parasol and shoes, they go together. It means walking, you know, for the feet, and then an umbrella for the sun. A seat, grain, and even if this doesn't have that, vegetables. Yeah, even or just some vegetables. In this way, give pleasure to the teacher. So whatever he has, he can give. In other words, it's not that I've done this, now you give me this. Many times you go and ask. So the teacher, knowing the position of the person, may ask for something, or just say you give whatever is according to your means. If they're from a wealthy family, you may get something wealthy. If he's not, he may get something simple. But the point is it's his duty. Like that. The teacher's duty is to teach. And the student's duty is to learn and serve. So he does his duty. And then if he gets some reward for that, that's up to the Lord. He's not specifically trying to get. A perpetual student, means a naistika, must, if his teacher dies, serve his son, means the teacher's son, provided he is endowed with good qualities, or his widow, or his... In other words, if he's made a vow to remain in the house of the teacher, then naturally when the father goes, the son takes that becomes his seat. So then the son is endowed with good qualities, then he'll continue his service there. Because he's gained the knowledge already, even if the teacher's not there. He practices the knowledge given, in other words, the siksha of the teacher. And when he performs service, he gets realization. So he'll continue to make advancement, even if the teacher is not present. But he performs that service. In other words, the naistika brahmachari has taken the vow to always maintain a mood of menial service, humble, submissive service attitude. And that affords him the greatest opportunity for dynamic realization. So once if one lives with the teacher, one can get more and more and more knowledge. But even if the teacher is gone, that knowledge is always potent. And if one follows it, and perform service in that knowledge, then one advances very nicely. (clears throat) 248. Should none of these be alive, he must serve the sacred fire, standing by day and sitting during the night, and thus finish his life. In other words, he serves the sacred fire and performing the Gayatris. Because of the Gayatri, it's mentioned that in the morning, if you stand, it keeps you from falling asleep. And in the evening, because after a long day, one has been very busy and active, the mind is overactive. So if one sits, it makes the mind more peaceful. So in other words, by performance of sacrifice, by japa, by remembering what has been learned, and by practical sacrifice. So here is the sacrifice, means the yajna. So for us means the Sankirtan yajna, chanting the holy names, studying the Bhagavatam, distributing the transcendental knowledge. That is the sacrifice. So that must be continued until he finishes his life. In other words, one must, like that. 249. A brahmana who thus passes his life as a student without breaking his vow reaches after death the highest abode and will not be born again in this world. So then, because of that determination, that fix to serve properly, then one very nicely, can go back to Godhead. So the whole point is, it says a brahmana who thus passes. The Prabhupada has given us the brahminical culture. This is a very, very important aspect to understand, is that there's a culture and based on one's values that one has, and then there's the occupational duties. See, in the Varnashram system, then you have two kinds of people following it. Those who are just pious, but not necessarily devotees. And so they are following this, and they are benefited. But they think they identify with the varna and ashram that they are in. Yeah. So therefore, they'll follow the culture of their particular varna, and in this way, go through their life. But Prabhupada points out that of all the varnas, Brahman is the highest. And of Brahmins, then you have three levels. The Dvija, which means one who has been initiated into the Gayatri Mantra, and now has the qualification to chant the Gayatri and to perform worship. But he has no knowledge. Then when he gains knowledge, he's called a Vipra. He has knowledge, he knows how to apply that knowledge. He's known as Vipra. Then when he actually realizes what all this knowledge is for, then he becomes Dvija. I mean, then he becomes Vaishnava. Because he actually understands the Vedic knowledge is for serving Krishna. There's no other purpose of the Vedic knowledge. Therefore, he dedicates his life to serving Krishna. So any person who understands that the purpose of life is to serve Krishna is automatically a Brahmin. So now, this sounds it's very clear and straightforward. But then the problem comes is then, well then how do I, does that mean I have to perform brahminical duties? So now if we look at here, then the answer comes, quite clearly when we understand that it was the realization that what he was doing was in relationship to Krishna that made him the topmost Brahmin, a Vaishnava. It wasn't the performance of the brahminical activities that made him a devotee. It's the understanding that these activities are meant to be engaged in the Lord's service that made him a devotee. So therefore, if we perform any of the varnic activities for the purpose of pleasing Krishna and in connection to Krishna, that makes one a topmost devotee, a topmost Brahmin. So therefore, for the devotee, he has the understanding and the culture and the values of the topmost Brahmin. It means that everything he's done is in relation to Krishna for pleasing Krishna. But he may follow the particular occupational duty of his own varna. With no problem. So this is a very interesting thing. So for the karma, it's very easy. The occupation he's doing is the culture that he follows. But for the Vaishnav, then he follows the culture of the Brahmin. Though he may have the occupational duties of another varna. Like that. It's a very interesting thing. Very interesting aspect that is there. That makes it confusing. This is the thing, is the hidden, the rahasya. It means that Krishna in the Gita, in the first six chapters and the last six chapters, he's discussing very much the how to engage the, he means, perform devotion, your prescribed duties for Krishna in knowledge. He's describing Nishkam Karma Yoga. In the first six, he's describing more on the karma aspect, the activity aspect, like action in Krishna consciousness, karma yoga, action in Krishna consciousness, or the third chapter is karma yoga. So he's discussing these. And he's talking about knowledge. Then in the last, last six chapters, he's discussing more strongly the knowledge by which you perform the prescribed duties. So it's very, you're performing the prescribed duties of a kshatriya, then you do it with detachment. Okay, that's very easy. Very straightforward. Now then in the middle six, then he starts talking about what is the topmost knowledge. The hidden knowledge. Like that. So that is bhakti. So this is the thing, is that we're performing our duties, but the hidden element is bhakti. That is the actual essential element. That is the most important aspect. So this bhakti becomes essential. So now if we can understand these two together, that I perform whatever my prescribed duties for bhakti, then whatever the platform, I'm elevated. Whatever the platform, that is sannyas. Because your activity is not being done for your own fruit. It's being done for the pleasure of the Lord. It means before I get the fruit, the fruit's already Krishna's. I'm only doing the work for Krishna. Right? Krishna says, if you can't surrender fully to him and become a pure unalloyed devotee this moment, then you follow the paths of sadhana bhakti. He says, and if you can't do that, then you work for me. So work for me, then we see Prabhupada starts talking about varnashram in the purport. So then, according to our nature, the Varna and Ashram, we situate ourselves and work for Krishna. So the result is Krishna's. The best is Nishkam, is that before I start the work, it's Krishna's result. Whatever comes is by Krishna's grace, and whatever it is, it's Krishna's. And less than that is Sakam. You know, at least we give something to Krishna. Right? And if we can't do that, then okay, just, you know, do whatever you can, but don't create any trouble. You know? Be a nice guy. So he's pointing out is that you're working like this. You work for Krishna. Whatever it is Krishna's work. That is how the devotee sees it. The karmi sees it. This is my work for getting the fruit and result I want. And the jnani, because he's very selfish, he sees when I do work, I do it for fruit. And the fruit gives pain. I don't want any pain. Therefore, I will not do any work. He's a miser. Even though we think so renounced, he's a total miser. Right? At least the karmi, good karmi, gives 50% of his results away. But the jnani is giving nothing away. Right? Because he doesn't want to do anything because he can't enjoy what he gets. So therefore he's not doing it. He's the most miserly. So the devotee understands that this work is Krishna's work. It's not my work. It belongs to Krishna. Therefore, then it becomes wonderful. Because it's Krishna's work. Then it becomes very nice. So this is the devotee is a Brahmin. He situates himself in that culture. That culture means the culture of seeing what everyone's doing in relationship to Krishna. That is the essential element. So it's the consciousness that makes a devotee. Right? The difference between a Kanista, Madhyama, and Uttam, we don't say, well, the Madhyama, you know, is more clever at business. Or the Uttama is like, you know, it's like, okay, Kanista is, you know, he's a panwala down at the corner, you know, like that. And Madhyama is, you know, he's got a flourishing business, you know, and then the Uttama is the, you know, national, you know, corporate manager, you know, like that. I mean, international corporate manager. No, it's not like that. That's not. It's realization. It's faith. It's his chanting. It's his realization. Therefore, externally, you won't see any difference. So this was the question that Gadadhar Pandit brought up. Is that how I'm going to learn from a materialist? He came and saw Pundarik Vidyanidhi, and he sees this guy sitting on a big fancy throne, and he's being fanned with fans, and he's, you know, all nice clothes and, you know, special smells burning, and all this, and he thinks, how am I going to learn anything from this materialist? So then that devotee he was with then thought, oh, he understood the mind of Gadadhar Pandit. And then he recited a verse from Bhagavatam. And Pundarik Vidyanidhi, hearing this, just, you know, fell off his throne and was rolling on the ground like that and flailing his arms, breaking things and not caring, and did this for 6 hours. You know? Then Gadadhar Pandit understood, well, maybe I made a mistake here. I miscalculated. So it's not what is being done, it's the quality that it is being done in. Therefore, the Brahminical culture, that is the culture of the devotee. That is the sincere devotee, that's the culture, like that. The occupational activity, that's another thing. That is according to the conditioned nature, the body and the mind and the intelligence. Whatever the body, mind, intelligence we have, we do something that fits that. If it's intellectual work, we do that. If it's physical work, we do that. It doesn't matter. Because whatever it is, we're going to do it for Krishna. Okay. Then it becomes perfect. So someone who understands this, like that, and doesn't break his vow, Krishna says in the Gita, one who performs, you know, one who is always steadying his devotional service without falling down, then he realizes Krishna. So So this is the point. So a devotee who situates himself in proper understanding, properly serving in a menial way, meaning, in other words, the brahmachari, he performs the service, whatever the service is, the result is never his. He goes begging, it's the teacher's. He's doing the daily sacrifices, the result is the teacher's. He's going out and collecting firewood and everything else, it's all for the teacher. He's cleaning the ashram belongs to the teacher. So whatever he does, it's the teacher's. And he's fully dependent upon the teacher. The teacher gives him his clothes, gives him his food, gives him his place to stay. Tells him when he studies, when to stop studying, when to get up, when to rest. Whatever he's supposed to do in the day, he tells him. So he's totally dependent. So this is the practice. The devotee is dependent always on the Lord. Whatever activity he does, the result is for the Lord's. Doesn't matter what it is. Like that. So this is the purpose of the brahmachari training. Is that throughout life one sees like this. And if one has this vow to always engage everything in Krishna's service, then that person goes back to Godhead. So that's what's mentioned here. Any questions on that? Because that ends the second chapter. Then after that, then the next chapter, tomorrow's chapter, then it gets into the graduation and then marriage now of the student. Any questions? Yes.
Maharshi, there's one verse about if the guru died, the Manashika Brahmachari should just stay in the ashram. But it seemed there was no provision for him to actually become a teacher himself. So I was wondering how in Vedic times the person actually became a teacher.
Well, here the Naistika generally, in the general sense, just didn't leave the ashram. In the Naistika would just stay in the ashram. Because all there was were the ashrams and the homes. You know? Here you're not dealing so much with mutts and temples and like that. Here you're dealing with you're either in your own home or you're in the teacher's home. So you're always in a home. So it just matter whose it is. So in your own home, then you're going to work for your own benefits, or your own family's benefits. But in the teacher's home, you're only going to work for the teacher's benefit. So it's just a matter of whether you want to situate yourself as nishkam or sakam. Like that. That's the main difference here. You know? But Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur was mentioning that the one can go directly from brahmachari to sannyas without going through grihastha or vanaprastha. And we see many of the sages, munis, they would go from brahmachari into vanaprastha. They didn't take sannyas, but they didn't get married. You know? So they would do that. They would, the hermits and stuff like that. They would live like that. Because generally the teacher meant that then he was doing his own study, but then also working for his own. He was working for himself. So the difficulty comes is that as the Naistik Brahmachari, then it's very easy to understand. I mean, it's very easy to maintain this nishkam mood. While as a grihastha, there's the tendency to. There may be the tendency to forget that, and it may become sakam. But there's plenty of example of grihasthas who are nishkam. That's not a problem, we see. You know, so it's there. Bhaktivinoda Thakur is an example of this. It means whatever he was doing was only for the purpose of preaching and this and that. Even being the district magistrate was just to demonstrate that the Vaishnavas weren't just a bunch of, you know, lazy bums. Because at the time of Bhaktivinoda Thakur, the only Gaudiya Vaishnavas that were known were the Sahajiyas. And they were just beggars, you know, of a very low character and, you know, low standard of devotional activities. So, I mean, very you know, degraded and immoral and all that. So no intelligent person in society cared at all for Gaudiya Vaishnavism, because those beggars had no philosophy and they had no character. You know? So therefore he established himself very nicely as a district magistrate, very prestigious position, even still today in India. You're a district magistrate. I mean, it's a very prestigious position. Because in a district, they're in charge of everything. Everything falls under them. The police and all other things are under them. The judiciary and the police is all under them. They're the top in the district. So it's a very prestigious position. I think there's only, I forget how many, 900 or 1,000 districts in India. I don't know if it's still like that, but that was what it was at the time Bhaktivinoda Thakur. So in a whole country of 900 million people, you have 900 people who are district magistrates. So it's a very prestigious position. Not only that, generally they were always British. I think there were only 5 Indians at the time who were district magistrates. Right? And of, you know, so, and of, and of the district magistrates, Bhaktivinoda Thakur was the best. Means other district magistrates had court decisions pending for months and months and months. He had nothing pending. Whatever came in today, he finished today. You know? It was like that. He'd hear both sides, and he'd make a decision according to the law. And no one could believe it. It even came and tested. You know, word got out, because it's okay if you had a British gentleman who had such, you know, uncanny ability. Then it was, you know, fine, you know. But if an Indian has, you know, one of the savages has this ability, and he's the best of all the DMs, I mean, it's like, you know, it doesn't... So then some envious people came and checked, but then they saw all his decisions were exactly backed up by law. And the decisions were correct and good. So they left him alone. He was, you know, so much so respected that when he said, I want to be transferred to Krishnagar, and they said no, and he says, okay, I resign. And they said, okay, we'll let you go. And he says, I'm going to stay here in Mayapur. I don't want to go sit in Krishnagar. He says, okay, we'll build a train line. That train line, that little choo-choo train line there, that was built by the British government just so Bhaktivinoda Thakur can go from his house to the court every day. That was the reason it was built. So that was his position. Now, from that position, then he's educated, has a great position. Now he can preach very nicely. And who are all of his friends? All at the time, all the top leading intellectuals, you know, of the time. These were all the different people. You know, it mentions so many names. There were big people in the leaders in the Indian scene at the time. Because Bengal was the seat of all, like, the intellectuals and culture. And he was moving with them, friends with them. He'd sit and discuss with them philosophy, what they thought. You know, they'd be discussing, you know, what Emerson said or Thoreau, and he'd be throwing, hey, he has this point here and this and that, and get right into it. And they'd be right into it, and then he'd bring it around to the Bhagavatam. And, you know, and then this point here is brought out even deeper in the Bhagavatam. He's, Emerson had a fabulous point here. And then he brings that out, and then he shows that how, you know, how nice it is, and picks it apart so you see all the different parts, you know, and people think, wow, this is amazing, and we didn't look at it like that. And then he takes it and shows how in the Bhagavatam all those parts are explained. So therefore, if you really want to know this and go really deep, you got to get into Bhagavatam. He's very, very clever. He would never fight with them. He'd always take what they're saying and just take what they were saying and then use it against them. Yeah. Original philosophical Aikido. you just use their own thing against them. He would just take whatever, he'd even sit there and discuss, you know, the Bible, anything. You bring up any philosophy, he would discuss it. He would find a good point in it and then bring that in line with Krishna consciousness. So his position, his intelligence, you know, and all that. Therefore, he was able to preach and establish that we can get, that we can be accepted today as bona fide, you know, devotees, sadhus, by the intellectual class of India, an aristocratic class of India, is only because of Bhaktivinoda Thakur. Otherwise, the Sahajiyas had made such a mess. Then Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur could establish the mutts, and then the preaching, you know, and that dynamic. Otherwise, before that, it wasn't there. You know? It wasn't there. So he reestablished. So therefore, whatever he was doing, he was a grihastha, but everything he was doing was for the preaching. Like that. It didn't mean he didn't maintain himself. You know, he's getting money from his job. He had 12 kids. You know. So he's showing he was just like everybody else, you know. But he also showed that he wasn't like anybody else, writing so many books and, you know, doing everything so perfectly, like that. So it's, the examples are there. So many are there. This is the Bhagavatam, the Chaitanya Charitamrita is for, to show. You know, and Arjuna on the battlefield, that was Nishkam Karma Yoga. He's fighting for Krishna. You know? No other reason. It pleases Krishna. Like that. Krishna wants this battle, because he wants to remove the burden of his earth, the earth, so therefore I'll fight and please Krishna. Does that make any sense?
Mm-hmm. I was also trying to understand how somebody became a teacher, that only on the order of their guru.
Generally, once they would, yeah, generally it's on the order of guru, but once one graduates, where he's qualified, then he can go and teach.
Or just approach him.
Yeah, like that, depending upon his how much he knows. Like that, it gave that there's those who know the whole Veda, its applications, and its hidden meanings. And that's the top. Then below that, then that is someone who knows a particular area very well. They know that area completely. But they don't necessarily know the hidden, you know, they may know applications, but they don't know the hidden meanings. It means they don't know how to connect their subject to Krishna. And like they may be great Sanskrit pundit, but they don't see the connection between Sanskrit and Krishna. So they're called upadhyayas. One who knows how the subject matters connect to the Lord, that's called acharya. And then, it says, then below that is just someone who has some knowledge in the area. Or he just knows the Vedic verses. He can teach you the shlokas. But he can't teach you their application. Like that. You know, so he knows some part. And then it goes down below that. It's just, you know, you're just learning an art or something. You can learn that from anybody. Like that. So these different aspects were there. But that's generally for once one has graduated here. But otherwise, then, when you know, for ourselves in the situation which we're doing, means that when others feel that one is qualified, you know, one has the character, one has the knowledge, then one can teach. You know? And Prabhupada also mentioned that, you know, the devotees have their own system. Materialists, then they're qualified for a long time, then they get the position. The devotee gets the position, and then by performing those duties becomes qualified. Like if you're sitting and talking on Bhagavatam and telling devotees that they must, you know, surrender to Krishna, then you yourself have to start looking and saying, well, am I surrendering to Krishna? Like that. So like that, it works. We have, Prabhupada mentioned that, we have our system, the karmis have theirs, you know. So it's, you especially see that, yeah, I mean, you see that everywhere. Especially you see that in India. You know, you just walk into any big man's office and, you know, politicians and this and that. Because we're devotees. If we weren't devotees, we couldn't do that. You know, to get appointments and this and that and recommendations, and then you might be able to see the person. Well, you just walk in, sit down, give him prasad, talk about Krishna. You know.
your samadhi.
You explained that the brahmachari, by serving the spiritual master, you can go back to God, like expecting that he's developing knowledge and realization. And if you explain also that the wife, by performing menial duties, can also go back to God and let.
Technical problem
that
here.
Wow,
what's going on? That, both those are there. See, in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, then Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami, then he mentions that. So you have the internal potency as three parts, sandini, samvit, sladini. So the samvit is the knowledge potency. Then when one engages that knowledge potency in devotional activities, means you perform activities in knowledge with devotion, means with sladini. So when you combine samvit and sladini, and perform devotional activities, then sandini potency reveals knowledge. She gives the realization. Otherwise, it means it'll just stay theory. But it changes from theory into realization or practical. It goes from gyan to vigyan when this combination of samvit and hladini is combined in devotional activities. That's why Krishna in the Gita is saying, perform your prescribed duties in knowledge with devotion. Because that gives a realization. So the whole idea is that one has gained that knowledge. And then one, how do I say? And one performs the menial service. Because menial service means that in a humble way you're performing the service. Like that. So that any devotee can have that mentality. See, we see the difficulty in some of these, and we were discussing before, the hidden understanding in this, is that you're dealing with basically parallel realms. Because it's just like, how you say, you have an object and you have its shadow. I mean, or its reflection in the water, right? So you can, if you bring these together, then they look exactly the same, but one has substance and one doesn't. So then, when we're dealing with the Vedic culture, or we're dealing with sadhana, right? Because these are our realms of work. We haven't surrendered to Krishna fully, right? Krishna gives that as the first option. We have not taken that. Or at least I speak for myself. I shouldn't do so. I see. Proud to say no one. So myself, we have not surrendered to Krishna. So therefore, we're not on the platform of prema bhakti. You know, the gopis just surrendered. The wives of the yagyik brahmins just surrendered. So Krishna recommends that. That's the best path. It's the quickest and it's the easiest. You just 100% surrender. Finish. You know, you go from you know, Shraddha to Prema in a moment. You know, it's the best process. But if you can't do that, then you follow sadhana bhakti. And that will take you gradually step by step through there. And if you can't be satisfied just in sadhana bhakti, that means just chanting, reading Bhagavatam, preaching, taking prasad, you know, our worship of the deity, living in the Dham, bus. In other words, the first aspect that Prabhupada gave us, the first lifestyle, the first temple experience, was, okay, they can't do that, then sadhana bhakti. Just that. And then as he was saying, they're having trouble with that, you know, 64 rounds, and, you know, we just absorb ourselves. You know, sometimes one devotee was telling me, and Prabhupada on the train, they were, I forget where they were riding from to where, but in India, they were driving usually from, you know, Vrindavan to Mayapur or Vrindavan to, you know, Bombay. And Prabhupada, for 12 hours straight, just spoke philosophy. There's the devotees that were traveling with them on the train. You know, I mean, they just were passing out. So probably just like 12 hours straight, just philosophy, just talking, everything about Krishna. Just to show that one can talk all day. You know, but who is keeping up with it? You know? So therefore, then he starts to introduce the elements of the dharma, the Vedic dharma, which is the varnashram. You know, you have your different elements, you know, your brahminical duties, your brahmachari duties, grihastha duties, all these different aspects. You know, he introduced just a little bit, because in the sadhana, it's there, just a touch, you know, just enough to make it happen, to hold it together so you actually have a social structure. Because you have to have some hierarchy, otherwise, how do you establish relationships? The relationships are those above you, equal to you, and junior to you. I mean, that's relationships. And then different degrees of intimacy on all these levels. But that's what you have. So you have to have enough just to establish that. But when that's not there, then you see as time went, Prabhupada was talking more and more and more about varnashram. 1976, very heavily talking about varnashram. Establishing varnashram community. It's a natural step for our preaching to expand. But it was also seen as a great necessity for devotees. Because very few were showing that basically just sadhana they could do. They also had to very much deal with their conditioned nature, which was showing itself very strongly. So you have these things. So they're there. They're like parallel levels. You have the original, spiritual, the Bhagavat. Then you have the Pancharatrik, which is also transcendental, which just takes one through step by step. Means what there's what's happening naturally, and then there's what's happening by rules and regulations. In other words, you have the spontaneous path, and you have the rules and regulations path. So until you come to spontaneity, then rules have to be there. And then below that, also you have the Vedic path running. And if you look at it, it's all the same. Because it's all from this original reflection. The original reflection is there. It means in the original, we see Mother Yashoda is bathing Krishna. In the reflection, then we see the devotee is bathing the deity of Krishna. Right? And then means, how you say, it's not exactly the, how you say, means that put into sadhana, then is that, we're bathing the deity of Krishna. Right? Or, as devotee, yeah. Then we go down into the culture of that, then we see, you know, mother is taking care of her child. You know? Why is it the mother bathes the child, not the child bathes the mother? Because that's the way it works in the spiritual realm. You don't find any of these social, cultural things happening here that aren't basically based on the ones there. Though some of them will say we don't agree with. You know, like the Parakiya Rasa here doesn't fly, but it does in the spiritual realm. But we see the children are submissive to the parents, not the other way around. Right? Because that's just the way it is. Friends have a particular relationship. They laugh, they joke, they do everything together, you know, they make, you know, comments about each other, they eat together, you know, because that's what Krishna does with his friends, you know. He takes care of his cows, the cows don't take care of him. He takes the cows out to the field, not that the cows go, okay, Krishna, time to go out and, you know, mow some grass, you know. No, Krishna takes the cows out. Like this, you know. Young boys, young girls, Krishna and the gopis. You don't see him out dancing with the old gopis. He's dancing with the young gopis. And not the real young gopis. No, the ones that are within the realm of puberty. You know? So it's all working. Why? Because it's reflecting from there. And no one thinks twice about that. Because these are all natural things. Like, you have a child. He'll ask, why is the sky blue, right? Or he'll ask, why is the grass green? Has any child ever in history, from any country, when you say, who's that? Oh, that's this kid's father. Does he ever ask, what's a father? Or, this is that person's wife. The 3-year-old, does he ever ask, what's a wife? Never. They just know. It's natural. Right? Different species, sometimes you can see colors you can't. So therefore you wonder, why is it this life it looks green? You know, last life it looks something else. But this whole thing of just these relationships between husband and wife, parent and child, friend, master and servant, or just some appreciation of somebody, no one has any problem with. Maybe they like or don't like, but everyone works within this. Within these, there's no relationship outside of this. It's fixed, because it's reflecting from the spiritual realm. So you have this. So that's Vedic. What's given in the Vedic culture is just those rules and regulations that are meant for going back to Godhead. But they're also meant to bring people to the path of going back to Godhead. So you make them you make them pious. You know? It would be like this. You offer prasad to Krishna and take Krishna prasad. That is reality. You know, we see when devotees would say, oh yes, we're making people into vegetarians, and Prabhupada said, well, pigeons are also vegetarians. He wasn't impressed. Right? Because just being a vegetarian doesn't mean you're a devotee. Devotee means you'll be vegetarian. So you make them a devotee, they're automatically that. But vegetarian is just a pious thing. Right? The reason we're vegetarian is that's what Krishna eats. I think Prabhupada mentions, he says, we're not vegetarian, we're Krishnatarian. Yeah, because Krishna eats these things, we eat that. If Krishna ate bicycles, we'd offer bicycles and eat those. You know? He eats vegetables. You know? And like that. So therefore, that's what we offer. So the Vedic culture means you recommend that people be vegetarian. Then it'll be very easy for them to take prasad. Means when you come along with the idea of now take your vegetarian things and offer them to Krishna, it's just an easy step. Now it's instead of thinking I'm cooking for myself, I cook for Krishna. But the same things you cook. Instead of just putting it on my plate, I'll put it on Krishna's plate. So it's a very minor adjustment. So the Vedic culture is bring them as close as you can, and then if they're actually sincere, then somebody will come along and just push them over that little brink. You know, just change their view of it. So you don't have to change the whole culture. You just have to change that how they view what they're doing. So therefore, we take the Vedic culture because it supports our conditioned nature, but only if it's in connection with Krishna. Otherwise, if it's not in connection with Krishna, it doesn't really have any meaning. It means it's pious, it's nice, okay. But as preachers, that's not where we are preachers of the fast path. We're not preachers of the slow path. Slow path is just be vegetarian, you know, and then maybe after I don't know how many millions of lifetimes you might come in contact with a devotee, you know, or you like vegetarian food stuff, so you might, you know, go by and, you know, see a food for life. You know, what's this? Oh, it's vegetarian, and take some. You know? But we're not preachers of the slow path. We are preachers of the fast path. The fast path is this life, understand we're devotees of Krishna, and then engage in all these things. So the Vedic is a support, and it's part of it's from the original reflection. So that we take the original, and we have a reflection. How are we going to get from the reflection to the original? What is the process? Therefore we stick sadhana in the middle. And that is, because the rules and regulations of sadhana are the same as you know, the rules of the Vedic culture. So therefore, we can take all our social stuff, right, and then just through that medium of the sadhana, then bring it to the transcendental platform. So from the Vedic, through the Pancharatrik, we get the Bhagavad. But we always have to understand the Bhagavad is the path. That is the substance. And Pancharatra is a substance because it's showing how to engage all the activities in Krishna's service, all the ritualistic stuff. And then the broader social things in our dealings, then that the Vedic affords us. But we still have to see that in relationship to Krishna. So with that three together, it works very nicely. Our whole complete culture comes. So if we neglect, you know, any of them, then there's a problem. But if you're only going to have one, take the Bhagavad. Chant Hare Krishna, doesn't matter what you're doing, what your lifestyle, what your anything. Just do that. You chant.
Very difficult.
Yeah, of course. I mean, in the beginning, it's just like you'll see somebody, they're not vegetarian, they, you know, they're not clean, you know, they only take bath on Wednesday night, you know, and that, but they chant Hare Krishna and they start advancing. Because the Bhagavat has the power. That is independent. Pancharatra is dependent upon following a Brahminical culture. You know, and the Vedic means you have to be human. You know, the minimum of the Vedic culture is you have to be human. The minimum of the Pancharatra is you have to have Brahminical realization. You know, or interest. Like that. So they're dependent upon conditions. Well, the Bhagavat's not. Like that. So we start with that. So we see Prabhupada injected that first. Started with chant Hare Krishna. Doesn't matter your situation, just chant. Don't have to change anything. Right? Like that, that original thing from the Brahma Samhita. It's not an imposition on the mind. You don't have to change anything. You just chant. You know? And this way, then, by chanting, then you become purified. Then when you're purified state, then you can follow the Pancharatra. Right? Then you can put tilak, you can wear neck beads, you can wear devotional clothing, you can go to Mangalarti, you can take prasadam, all these different things. You know, you can follow the sadhana of the cook, the prasadam, right? And offer it. And if you can work with that only, fine. But if not, if still more desire is there in the heart, more purification, then you add in the Vedic codes. Which Prabhupada, his books are full of. He's always talking about how brahmacharis behave, grihasthas behave, vanaprasthas, sannyasis, how men behave, women behave, children behave, teachers, leaders, followers, you know, businessmen, everything he's talking about. So that is all from the Manasamhita. He quotes Manu, Yajnavalkya, Parasara. He says these are our Dharma Shastras. So we can only approach the Dharma Shastras through the eyes of the Bhagavad and the Pancharatra. We try to see it separate, we'll end up as Hindus. At best. Because you have to be actually quite pious to be a Hindu. Right? There must be a great amount of purity. But otherwise, yeah, must be seen through that. Then we can see how the whole culture works and how it goes together. How the dealings are here. It means we'll take it. Okay, the teacher, he's the respected, and the student is the one who's offering the respect. And that's it. Bus. Right? But we see in the Vedic culture, that aspect is there. But at the same time, as the teacher is also respecting the student. There's limits of what he can do, what he can ask him to do. His methods of teaching. His methods of discipline. Means it very much does all those things. So if we just take certain aspects and just take them in a you know, very simplistic Western way, then we run into problems. Because the Vedic culture is very refined. Because you're dealing with personalities. And no, personalities aren't simple. They're very complex. Where someone's strong in one area, he's weak in another. You know? Therefore, it's like, we take husband, wife. Husband's in control, wife follows. Bas. And therefore, the Westerners can't figure out how to make the institution work. Right? Karmis haven't figured it out. You know? So the devotees with the same mentality aren't going to figure it out either. But we see here so many positions where the husband is you know, the influential element, or the wife is the influential element. Depending on the situation, their personality is this. And so there's a very natural cooperation and give and take. So this aspect is there. We have to understand the 50-50 point. Vedas means 50-50. And we say one leads, one follows, that's 100% and zero. But Vedas is 50-50. So in the different situations, then one is predominant or the other. And this way it makes it work. Like that. Like I was watching in somebody's house. Went there for lunch. And, you know, so when it comes to how to arrange the house for serving the lunch, then the wife knows how to do that. I mean, I was watching the husband there. He's trying to figure out, well, I'll put this here and this and there. And the wife just says, forget it. Put all that down. Just put this here and there. And he goes, no, it's still this and that. He says, this, you sit down, I'll do it. You know? In 2 seconds, she just put everything how most people could sit down in the room. You know, her husband's putting this here and that was getting in the way and moving that there. And it was just completely crazy. Just did it, 2 seconds. Like that. So she knows how to run those things. Like that. So then in that way, then it takes that aspect. Or there's things to serve, then what preparation, what goes with what, this, that, wife says. The man says, I know what's inside, you know, I'll put the, you know, the salad on the, what is it, oh, funny thing. Salad dressing, you know, goes on the cake, you know. Things like that. I've seen it before. You know. Because the guy serving thought, I know what's going on. But this is false ego. So the whole point is cooperation means that we're not dealing with false ego. False ego is that we still identify with the body. Or at least we identify with the desires of the body. Therefore, the Grihastha Ashram is for the purpose of removing that false ego. So one pure living entity has the desires of a man. Another one has the desires of a woman. You put those two together and they engage those desires cooperatively in Krishna's service, it burns out both of them. And then both of them go back to Godhead. So that's the thing. There's no question of, you know, how you say, the false ego being the prominent element. If it is, it can't work. The ego is there, you cannot remove the desire. Because you understand, it's for Krishna. It's Krishna's rules. We're following it. We do it for Krishna. And then in this way we get the result. So it's a very simple science, but there's a lot of detail. It means the principles are very simple. But the details are very fine, because they're dealing with personality. They're dealing with rasa, relationship. So if one can understand that, in other words, a restriction creates relationship, right? Just like you have husband and wife. Now, if the husband doesn't go looking or spend time with other women, he restricts himself. That increases the relationship with his wife. And the wife is the same, it increases the relationship. So restriction creates relationship. The mother restricts herself. She may have other things she would maybe like to do. She restricts those and takes care of the child. It deepens the relationship with the child. And that child benefits. Now if we go into the modern, the mother, she has her agenda and she does it. You know, and the kid, you know, is hungry, you know, there's a TV dinner in the oven. You know, you just turn it on to 100, leave it for 10 minutes, and then you take it out and eat it. Then where's the relationship? Mother's doing what she wants. But what's going to happen is now the kid's going to start doing what he wants. And then everyone's going to wonder, what happened to our wonderful family? So restriction creates relationship. And the greater the restriction, the tighter the relationship. And the less restriction, the less the relationship. You know? How do you know someone is just an acquaintance and an intimate friend? An intimate friend, doesn't matter what's going on, you need them, they will help. They decide they're going on, today we're going down this thing, and you've got, you know, your head's falling apart, then they'll cancel their trip and sit with you. You know, or invite you along. But they'll spend the time. So they've restricted themselves. And then you'll consider, this person is real friend. So this is the whole... It's a very dangerous trick of Maya, is that to create unrestriction, unregulation in a human being, means to create animals. Because human means restricted. Like that. Otherwise, then why would Krishna give us so much problem? You know, we'd all have a nice fur coat, you know, and we wouldn't have to worry about clothes, and we wouldn't have to worry about houses. I mean, we got to worry about so many things, you know, to create the lifestyle and all that. I mean, if the whole life was just being free, Krishna would have given all these things to us. But the restriction creates that. Because that restriction, you're going to have to restrict to serve Krishna. I want to go back to Godhead. I must restrict what I want to do and do it for Krishna. That's the first level. And then the topmost level is I want to serve Krishna in this particular rasa. Therefore, I can't do the activities of the other rasas. Right? Mother Jashoda decides to go out with Krishna and the cowherd boys and, you know, play leapfrog? Never. You know, the gopis ever come along in front of the Mother Jashoda, whack Krishna on the back and, you know, yuck it up? Never. You know? The cowherd boys, you know, go out, you know, for the rasa dance and sit around and, you know, eat popcorn? No. They're all in bed. So, like this, it's like each one has their service. And because of their rasa, therefore, it manifests in a certain way. And if you do something against that, it's called rasabhas. So therefore, the restrictions in the material world are, you do it in this way, it's called rasa. You do it, don't go against it, it's called rasabhas. Therefore, it gives so many rules. What is a brahmachari? You do those things, the rasa of brahmachari is maintained. The person has the mood of a brahmachari. Everyone can see that. They respect. They reciprocate. So the relationship is established. Now it'll go into grihastha life. The same thing. You follow these restrictions, it's a grihastha. You don't follow, it's a grihamedi. You don't follow even less, then, you know, it's divorce. So it's just reality. So when we understand human life means restriction, then we get down to the business to figure out, okay, what is my position? What are the restrictions? What is the purpose of them? And how do they connect to Krishna? And then we follow them, and then there's no problem. But if we doubt, well, because I don't like, or my mother never told me that, you know, then things don't look so good. Right? Things don't look so good. Like that. So that's the important element, is we must accept that human life is for restricting, you know, independence and connecting to Krishna. And that affords real independence. Because when we're independent of the desires, control of the senses, the mind, the ego, that's actual freedom. Right? Krishna in the Gita calls it the regulative principles of freedom. Right? It means you follow these, you actually are free. So the people say, no, I'm free, I don't follow, they're the most bound. They're the most bodily conscious. They're the most absorbed in distinction, adoration, and profit. And those who follow them, they're actually the liberated person. They're actually free. So we see Arjuna on the battlefield fighting. He's free. He's liberated. He's on the Brahma-Bhuta platform. So that's why Krishna in the Gita says, if we do our duties, then that nishkam purifies us. And that will bring us to the Brahma-Bhuta platform. The performance of our prescribed duties for Krishna brings us to nishkam karma. I mean, to Brahma-Bhuta. And then from there, then it's just you basically fall into prema. You know? From bhava to prema, it's not a great difficulty. You know? So that is the difficulty comes in bhajana kriya to asakti. That's where the difficulty comes. And basically it's through anartha nivritti.
Big ocean.
But anartha nivritti, once anartha nivritti is seriously started to be crossed, you know, then one becomes fixed in devotional service, one starts to develop a taste, and once one develops a taste, then things become very, very quick. That taste develops to attachment, then to, you know, bhava. So interesting things, you can take this, depending upon the audience, you can discuss it purely according to, you know, rasa and shraddha prema and all these different things. But the thing is, depends upon the audience, you bring out different points or not. But it's the same point. That's why you see many times Prabhupada will take, like a very good example of this is Prichina Barhishat, when he's hearing the story from Narad Muni, Puranjana, then next Puranjana becomes a woman, and Queen Vidarbhi, and she's serving Malayadwaj. So when Malayadwaj dies, and then he places him on the pyre and all that, and all, then she cries there. And then Prabhupada keeps going back and forth in the same person, purport, sometimes almost like sentence to sentence, paragraph to paragraph, between the spiritual master and the disciple and the husband and the wife. And then showing how even husband and wife, as husband and wife, performing grahastha duties can be paramahamsa. You know, so meaning this aspect, when you bring in this element of nishkam karma, it goes into such a totally different realm. The practicer of nishkam karma is the sannyasi. It doesn't matter what the varna or ashram is, or whether the male or female, there's sannyas. Because whatever they're doing is for Krishna, so they're not creating any fruit. So they're not actually of this world. But we haven't developed prema. We're in a stage lower than that. We're being purified. So it becomes another. So you'll see that these verses can be discussed in so many different layers. So you can take it at one layer and put it at another because the principle is the same. So you can go in and out. You can take this verse from Manusapita, discuss it as Vedic, discuss it as sadhana, discuss it as Bhagavat. Discuss it as in the level of, you know, the transcendental rasa. So it's just the same principle is there throughout. Because it's when the reflection of a tree or in the water looks like a tree. It doesn't look like a cow. It looks exactly like the same tree, but it doesn't have the depth. So therefore, someone who knows the tree can explain the reflection. Oh, this is the fruits here, and these are the leaves, and this is underneath the leaves, and this is the bark. But someone who doesn't really know what's there. He may call it bark. Yes, this is the bark, but he doesn't actually know it's bark, because someone else who knows the tree, that's not bark. But you just said it's the bark. It means, yes, it's the bark means it's the reflection of the actual bark. While the student is thinking the bark in the water is bark. No. It's not. It's a reflection of the real bark. So therefore, in the Vedic culture, you can point out this is this aspect of rasa. And this is this aspect of sadhana. So now it's just a matter of turning that around and connecting it to the real, the original tree. Then you get the benefit. Like that. So it's So the process is very dynamic, and depending upon what level you're working at, then you can discuss it that. Therefore, you'd see Prabhupada's always talking about how important our devotees and this and that, and we're devotees and we must preach. And then if some devotee makes some comment about the karmis and says, well, we're devotees, and Prabhupada just turns around and says, you're not a devotee. Devotee starts with prema. You're an aspiring devotee. So as soon as the ego is there, then immediately, you know, you're down on this level. If there's no ego, then the nitya siddhas and Krishna count you as one of them. But as soon as the ego is there, then wait a minute. You're a practicing devotee, aspiring devotee. You know, you still got a few more stages to go. You know, just to make it, you know, it's just like the child's in the family and all that, and he's there and all the relatives are there, and you know, it's so much, their attention will go on him. But if he starts to become proud and acts in a spoiled way, then it's just, he's a kid. Then it's kind of like, you know, go to the next room. You know, this is the adult scene. You know, you don't know how to behave in it, you go to the next room. You're just a kid. But if he comes and he's nice, he's submissive and deals nicely and just listens and, you know, doesn't bring the attention to himself, he's accepted as part of the scene. No adult will, you know, no, how you say, natural. It's the natural thing is that he'll be accepted as part of the scene. But as soon as he starts bringing all the attention onto himself, then it's different. It means if he doesn't do that, they put their attention on him. But if he brings the attention to himself, then he disqualifies himself. So therefore, you'll see is that devotees will try sometimes talk on one level, and Prabhupada will give seems to be an opposite answer. But it's just it's on the same. The principles are the same. Just this, which level you apply it. And it becomes, so it's a very interesting thing. So with that, then the whole thing becomes very, very, how do you say? Very alive and very dynamic and gives the result that we're looking for. Because you know? We're not interested in brahmacharya, grahastha, prasannyas. We're not interested in these things. But we're interested that we have a conditioned nature, how to engage that conditioned nature in Krishna's service. Therefore, we find that situation that fits our nature. And then according to those rules, engage it in Krishna's service. We may ask, well, why the rules? Because how else are we going to know how to engage it in Krishna's service? How else are we going to know? Like, how do you offer something to Krishna? There's a system, how Krishna accepts it. You take it, cooking in a nice way, clean certain things, put it on a plate, and offer to him. You know, offer prayers, ask him to accept it. He accepts it. If we just do whatever we want, you know, then you know while we're cooking, and then we just take one spoon out and say, you know, eat it, and then after, you know, this and that, and do what we want, and just say whatever we want. It doesn't necessarily. Krishna's not overly pleased. Okay, maybe you thought of him, and you know, laced you, you know. Rub-a-dub-dub, thanks for the grub, right? You know, so then, okay, it's better than nothing, but if you want serious, then there's some rules. So, but the rules come from Krishna. You know? The Manu Samhita is Krishna's words to Brahma. Brahma spoke to Bhrigu. And so we're hearing from Bhrigu here. This is Bhrigu speaking. You know, it's called Manu Samhita. It is Bhrigu speaking. And Brahma spoke to Narad. And Narad speaks the same points in Bhagavatam. You don't really find any difference.
All our acharyas.
Yeah, so like that. So they're speaking. So now we have to take this knowledge and how it's given to us by our acharya. Because all those chapters where it's talking about this Varnashram, same thing. Prabhupada gives then points in the purports. He tells us, you know, what a brahmachari does, how he lives, what a grihastha, how they live, vanaprastha, sannyas, the kings, this, that. And he makes these comments. And then following that, that is our Dharma Shastra. That is our Dharma Shastra. Then things become good. I don't know, did that... I don't know if we got anywhere in your question. Okay. Point is there's a natural mutual respect amongst devotees. And the different elements of the whole system are not for the purpose of ego and this and that. It's just like saying that the parents, you know, lead the child. Then it's not for the parents to get all proud and all this and become, you know, exploitive of the child. No, it's so that the parents know they're the ones that have to take care of the child. They have to protect the child. And the child knows that I don't know anything, I learn from the parents. So the parental ras is established in that way. But if we take it, and the child takes it that, you know, yeah, parental ras means whatever I want, they give. And the parents think it's just whatever I demand, they do. Then it won't work. You don't really have a family. So the whole point is one has to also understand the application. It means it pointed out is that knowing the Veda is good. It means knowing the Shastra, that is good. Knowing how to apply it, that's better. Because if you know the Shastra but don't know how to apply it, it's not very practical. But if you know how to apply it but don't apply it, then what's the use? So better than that is someone who knows the Shastra, knows how to apply the Shastra and applies it and lives it. And then best is someone who, from doing that, has gained realization. Then that is the best platform. But at least, minimum, we should look for the person who knows the subject, knows how to apply it, and does apply it themselves. Because then they can show by example. But otherwise, then, if we only know and we don't know how to apply, then it's a mess. You know? So we know the leader leads and the others follow, but we don't know how to apply that, then the temple president gets frustrated because no one does what he says, and the devotees in the temple get frustrated because they don't feel that they're being properly taken care of and properly, you know, guided. So one has to know how to apply. Then, socially, things can work. Otherwise, not a whole lot of chance. Little past time. So, we'll end here. Yeah, 5 o'clock. Tomorrow. Yeah, here. Here tomorrow. Okay, so we'll end here. Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.